Good morning from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. Welcome back to the second hour of Better Lawns and Gardens. We are going to have the Tomato Man with us, Lizzie, and so I am excited to...
I have seen his book. You showed it to me, and now I want tomatoes.
I know. That's what I think. It's a great week. We're going to have some good rain this week, so if you're just joining us, this is going to be a great gardening week. The temperatures are getting a little bit cooler. When I say that, I mean, mid to high 80s, low 90s, and with just a little bit of less humidity, not a lot, but it feels like fall is coming. And so I am going to look forward to this. Our tomatoes and peppers are growing, and also our arugula and our leeks and onions. We're so excited. And so we have a great show for you today. If you missed the first hour, you can go ahead and check it out on iHeartRadio, Audio Boom, wherever you listen to podcasts. It will be playing there, but you can hear all of the show in entirety. You can listen to it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or at 10 o'clock in the morning when you wake up normally, and you can hear it anytime. So we do thank you for being here today. Let's hear from John Denver. I think he's coming in now.
And now it's time for the dirty word of the day on Better Lawns and Gardens with Teresa Watkins.
And the dirty word of the day is amphigian. A-M-P-H-I-G-E-A-N, amphigian, from amphi and gian, from the Greek gaia, earth, and the English A-N. It is an adjective and was first used in 1857. It has two definitions, but the number two one is most exciting to me. But number one is in botany, it's a reference to a plant that has underground as well as aerial flowers. Some plants are amphigian in that they produce flowers from a rootstock. It also means that the various amphigian plant species or genera exist at about the same latitude around the world. So two examples of amphigian species that grow in Florida are royal fern, Osmunda regalis, and cinnamon fern, Osmunda cinnamonia. And so I think that's just very interesting that the flower produces underground as well as aerial flowers. So you can go onto our website, betterlawnsandgardens.com, and you can see the dirty word of the day and all the dirty words we use. So I love that. And cinnamon ferns and royal ferns are wonderful. They need shade. They also need to have lots of moisture. So doesn't mean you need to water them a lot. You need to plant them in areas that are low-lying, near lakeshore fronts, or in areas that you have a rain garden where water naturally sits. So that is a great plant, native plant for your woodland gardens or your tropical gardens. And the royal fern, it comes up, it looks like a crown. And when you see it, it's just very elegant. They're very tall, but they're not invasive or aggressive as the regular Boston ferns that we see that are going in the ground that are everywhere, because ferns spread by air spores, but the royal fern and the cinnamon fern are very well behaved in your garden. So we have a great show for you today. If you missed the first half hour on fall color, Florida does get a fall, and we do have trees that change color here. This is a great time of the year to be planting trees, and you can go onto our iHeartRadio and also to WFLA, and you can hear all of the past shows. Right now, fire ants, we're seeing a lot because we've had a little bit of moisture over the last 6 weeks, rainfall from Idalia. We're seeing more ants come to the surface. And so you want to make sure you're using an ant bait. You just don't want to spray for them because that's not going to really be effective. And what happens is when you startle or you attack a ant hill or a colony of ants, they have the queen in there and they will move the queen to a different location. And sometimes there may be two, even possibly three queens in the colony there. And when you do, you get three ant hills instead of one because they move all three of them. And so you want to make sure you're using a bait that will kill the queen. Once you kill the queen, then the whole colony will disappear. From the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios, it's Saturday morning. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network. Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins. With us right now is Craig LeHoulier. He is got a PhD in chemistry from Dartmouth College, which he used to start his pharmaceutical career for 26 years. But he became passionate about gardening in the 1980s and started growing tomatoes. He's an advisor for Seed Savers Exchange Organization, and he's responsible for naming and popularizing many well-known tomato varieties, such as one of my favorites, Cherokee Purple, Lillian's Yellow Heirloom, and Lucky Cross. In 2015, Craig published two books, Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales. He has a third book coming out this year on his dwarf tomato project. He's also a co-creator of a collaborative online tomato course called Growing Epic Tomatoes with world-renowned gardener Joe Lempiel as part of Joe's Organic Gardening Academy. Craig is a dad and grandfather with his wife, Susan, and his lovely pets, and he lives in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Good morning, Craig. I am so excited to have you on.
Good morning, Teresa. I so appreciate the chance to chat tomatoes with you and everyone. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome. And what's the weather like right now in North Carolina?
Oh, probably perfection is the word. There's a little bit of a fog burning off. It's going to be 64 degrees today and sunny. So we're going to head for the farmer's market after I do this little thing with you.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, no, that's great. I love that. So I saw you, Craig, 2 years ago on Joe Lempiel's Growing a Greener World, and I fell in love with your passion about tomatoes. What do you love about tomatoes?
Oh, kind of everything. No, but I think it would be the fact that the diversity of the types, the flavors, the fact that they actually reside in most every gardener's garden. So there's always a lot to talk about, and the stories that are often attached to them. So they just give a way to build community, to grow gardeners by sparking their interest, and you get to eat the results at the end. So. Nothing I can think about that's not bad about bad about growing tomatoes.
It's all good, and it's usually the starter plant that gets people involved in gardening. Was that the way it was with you?
What got me involved with gardening, actually, I was one of those really lucky people with a grandfather and a father that even at 2 or 3 years old would walk me through their gardens and show me what they were growing. And I caught the spark then later in life. So they planted the seed, took about 20 years to germinate. So my wife and I, as soon as we got married, one of the first things we did was have our garden, and we've had one ever since. So I've been gardening for 40 years now, and every year is a new adventure, which makes it also wonderful.
So how many tomatoes do you grow a year?
Oh, it varies from 100 to this year where I went temporarily insane and I was responsible for 180 different varieties. A lot to grow, a lot to assess, a lot to save seeds from, but we had a couple of big tastings and I learned a lot. The more tomato varieties you grow, the more you learn, which means the more you can share with people. And it just becomes so much fun.
That's amazing. So now you've moved from where you were in the Raleigh area up over to Hendersonville. Where do you grow your tomatoes? Do you have a lot more property now?
Pretty much the same amount of property. We have a nice flat backyard, but it's our septic system. So we have a series of, or we had, they're all done now, but straw bales and containers is where our backyard garden was, and we had about 70 tomato plants growing there. There is a plane going overhead, so I'm moving indoors temporarily. And then I had a really nice volunteer opportunity nearby. There's a veterans healing farm that works with gardeners with PTSD, and I was doing talks for them, and they have a greenhouse. And they essentially said, Craig, here's a greenhouse. Go forth and plant with our volunteers. And we had 115 different varieties there. So those were in the ground. So I had the chance to test varieties in ground, in containers, in straw bales. So as a former chemist, I was kind of a mad scientist with big laboratories to play with this year, and it made it a lot of fun.
That's great. Now, you talk about 180 varieties or 110 varieties. How do tomatoes vary? I know there's different colors, but what else is different about them?
So they vary in size and shape, productivity, plant habit. So you've got the really tall, gangly, out-of-control indeterminates. So you've got determinants, which stay in better control, dwarfs. We now have micro dwarfs. And the flavors vary all over the place. And interestingly, those flavors don't really correlate with the different colors. So for people to get the full tomato adventure, they just need to try things and find out what they themselves find grow well for them in their yard and what is it that they in particular love to eat. I've seen fights break out at tomato tastings over particular tomatoes where, you know, this and that one would say, no, it's too acidic. And people would say those same tomato, no, they're too sweet. So we often forget how different our perceptions of flavor are. And so we're all on this journey to kind of find our own favorite tomatoes when we garden.
That's nice to know that we don't all have to go down the same path. And so one of the common complaints in Florida is that tomatoes don't taste like they do up north. And mine are always tasty, but is there a secret for making tomatoes delicious?
I find that the overriding factor in tomato quality has been the genetics that control that variety. So, for example, I've grown Cherokee Purple in Pennsylvania, where it was first sent to me, several gardens there in Raleigh and in here in Hendersonville. And every time the flavor and the quality has been equivalent. So I think when people are having issues with tomato flavors, they're just not picking the ones that are particularly delicious. And a lot of times people that just get their plants from the big box stores, they try to aim it down the middle. They don't get anything too controversial. And the flavors are probably just going to be so-so. So it is worth a hunt. In my gardening career, I've grown about 4,000 types. And I could be people's guides towards finding them exactly what they want because I remember what all four thousand of those types actually taste like. So I've done a lot of work helping connect people with the exact type of eating experience that they're seeking. And it is possible to do that.
Wow, I bet that chemistry background really helps you with that.
It helps in creating the spreadsheets, and I do have mostly photographic memory. But I think the other thing that's really important is the full sun, keeping the plant healthy and happy. You know, various things come along. People say, well, you know, withhold water from your plant to make them taste better. There's the internet has some great stuff on it, and it has some totally bonkers wrong stuff on it. So I think people really they need to be careful where they get their gardening info from, but mostly it's common sense. Read your plant. Think about, well, when I'm hungry, what do I need? I need food. When a tomato plant's hungry, it needs to be fed. When it's wilting, it needs to be watered. And so I'm not a real, even though I'm a scientist, I go about gardening as if I'm discovering something new every day, and I'm in the plants a lot, looking at them, observing them, and just reacting to what they're showing me that they need. And that makes for a really nice couple of hours to spend in the garden when you can do that.
I bet. You always look so happy in your photographs, so I know it works. So can we influence the amount of sugar in tomatoes?
You know, not so much. I think you can probably make tomatoes taste worse by treating them very poorly. But a tomato will express its genetics, and it just turns out that all tomatoes are equally acidic. However, they vary very, very widely in terms of sugar content. So if people are seeking out tomatoes that have that good sweet flavor that they're seeking, they need to grow a variety that genetically is just going to, it's coded to produce a lot of sugar. So a lot of the pink beefsteak types, a lot of the red and yellow swirled heirloom types, they're very, very sweet tomatoes. And people looking for good sweet tomatoes really should focus on finding the varieties that are going to do that for them. And I think I do have a chapter in my book that talks a lot about selecting tomatoes as to what people are looking for as to that sweetness parameter. And it'll be worth checking the book out of the library and looking at that chapter, or just emailing me and I can be their guide through this important question.
That is great. We're going to get that contact information for everyone. So how much space do you need to grow a tomato?
Well, tomatoes are one of those crops that benefit most when you get really good air circulation around a plant and really good sun exposure. And we, in America, maybe the world over, gardeners in general, we really like to pack our plants in because early in the year they're small. We think, well, what about all this space? The garden gets growing, everything is crawling all over itself. And, you know, for flowers that may be okay, but for tomatoes that are too close together invite disease to happen. The sun's not getting to parts of the plant, so it can't do its disinfection job. So the fungal issues show up on the leaves with blemishes. So I like to go, when I'm growing in a straw bale, I do two to a straw bale, which spaces them at about 2 feet apart. Optimally, when I was growing in ground, I was keeping my tomatoes 3 feet apart. I like to be able to walk around them all the way. And even the garden we did this year in the greenhouse, they're too close. We get too ambitious. We want too many tomatoes, so we cram everything in. Next year, we're going to grow half the number of the tomatoes in the greenhouse, and I guarantee you the yield will be the same or better because we will reduce disease. The plants will be happier. There's less competition with the roots for nutrients. So it really is, if you can find the discipline to do so, space them 3 feet apart, and people's performance of their tomatoes will really elevate if they do that.
What are your recommendations for soil?
So I love to use, because I don't grow anything in the ground anymore here at the house, I need to find good material for my containers. And I found that just getting a bagged soilless potting mix, often they're called planting mixes, with the key element being black cow, compost to cow manure, because that adds micronutrients, but it also adds the ability of the potting mix to hold more water and not dry out so quickly. So whether it's a 2-to-1 ratio or a 3-to-1 ratio, I've found that really doesn't have to be specific on that. You do need to get that composted manure in with your soilless mix, and then the plants are really, really happy. And from that point on, I water them daily. We're in a hot area here in Hendersonville, and I feed them weekly. And I'm not fancy about the food. It's just an all-purpose fertilizer diluted out to a tablespoon per gallon. Each plant gets about a cup of that a week, and my garden just kicks butt and gives me everything that I need.
That's great, Craig. Now, I'd love to ask you a few more questions and talk about your excellent book, Epic Tomatoes. Can you stay through the break?
I certainly can. I look forward to it.
Thank you. So, Craig, how can our audience find out more about your website and all your tomato adventures?
Sure. CraigLahulier.com is my website, and it has a blog on it. And I am actually just in the process of doing my 2023 garden year summary. That's going to be a series of blogs. Email nctomatoman@gmail.com. And maybe the most important one at the moment is Instagram @nctomatoman, because people can find my 4 years of live videos that I've done in the garden through all 4 growing seasons, where I sit out there with my dogs and my plants, sweat like crazy, and just show people what's going on in the garden.
Thank you so much, Craig. We're going to be right back with more of the Tomato Man and his passion for growing tomatoes. I'm Teresa Watkins from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. It's Saturday morning. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens, and this is Florida's Talk and Informational Network. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. If you know someone who loves to garden or has a question, please let them know about Better Lawns and Gardens. Tell them to call in with their gardening questions so I can help them too. Welcome back. So we are talking with the tomato man, Craig LaHouliere, author of Epic Tomatoes and a second book, Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales. They're both available on Craig's website and at bookstores nationally and online. So, Craig, thank you for staying with us through the break. We were just talking about planting tomatoes, and in your Growing a Greener World segment, you did a really great demonstration of cutting off suckers. Can you talk a little bit about what suckers are on a tomato and why we should cut them off?
Sure. And really, this section applies only to indeterminate or tall-growing tomatoes. So anybody who's grown Cherokee Purple or Sun Gold, those are indeterminate. Determinate tomatoes like Roma, dwarf tomatoes really should not have any of their suckers removed. So a sucker forms every time a stem intersects leaves at a 45-degree angle. Growth comes out that essentially is nothing more than another major growing stem that will flower and produce fruit. People that actually cage their plants often won't remove any, or they'll remove just a few because they want maximum yield. Many of us stake our plants, so if we were to let all the suckers grow, the plant would become impossibly complex. It would pull the stake over. It would crawl all over the place. So I like to stake my tomatoes, and I usually use a strategy where I'm going to let two or three suckers proceed. So coming up the plant, I find them popping out between the stem and the leaf, and then I'll tie the main stem and those. Let's say I leave three of them go. That gives me four fruiting branches for that plant, and I just keep those tied to the stake. The thing is, the suckers will continue to pop up even on the suckers themselves, so you need to then be really disciplined and go there and snap them off every few days. That keeps your plant relatively clean. Air can get in. One thing that's useful, people will often let suckers grow to about 6 inches long, snap them off, put them in a glass of water, or put them in damp soil, and they will root. And it's a clone of the parent plant. And people can use this technique for succession planting. If they plant a set of tomatoes, they want to have a guarantee for risk in case something happens, bring a set of suckers along for each of those plants. You can grow them then. If something happens to your main plant, you can plant them in. They'll do just the same, or you can share them with friends and neighbors. So suckers shouldn't scare people, but you do need to address them because a plant over the course of a season will produce hundreds of them. Keep them in some sort of control.
Wow, that's really good information, because people I find are scared to cut their plants or prune them, and it's important to do that. And it doesn't hurt the plant or shrub or tree.
No, the same as topping. So if you have a 6-foot stake and the plant gets to the top of the 6-foot, just chop off that main growing tip, and that will then, you can let the suckers that are developing below take over. But I see so many, and this used to be in my own garden, the plants get so tall and you get a thunderstorm and they get top heavy and the winds with the storm will blow the plant over. Oftentimes we leave growth on a plant that's never going to mature tomatoes anyway by the time the season ends. Mm-hmm. So tomato plants are very resilient. They can take a lot. So have at it. Get your snippers and have at it and go and get that plant under control.
Yes. So let's talk about your book, Epic Tomatoes. And because I want to talk about seeds, but you have a chapter in seeds in Epic Tomatoes. Tell us about the book and what's your favorite chapters on it?
Sure. Well, it was definitely my labor of love. And, you know, once I got involved with Seed Savers in 1986, my knowledge grew pretty exponentially as I grew more and more tomatoes. And my wife used to say, when are you going to write your book? I'd say, well, I was still working at the time. Then Story Publishing approached me in 2012 and said they would like a tomato book for their portfolio. And I was so excited to finally download all of this information that had been crammed into my brain for all that time. I particularly love anything to do with stories and history. So flipping through that book, there's a lot on the history of the tomato, featuring some historic varieties, often paired with a seed catalog image for when it was released. And I think my love of this goes back to my love of my grandfather and always wanting to know what it was he grew in his garden. There's a section toward the back of the book where I recreate letters that people have sent to me over the years with their treasured seed. And that was one I thought about during a dog walk. I thought, I need to get Story to recreate some of these letters in the back of the book so people can get a sense of the beautiful writing, handwriting, that accompanied these seeds that came to me. Then there's one more appendix in the back that has a contest that I held in my gardens for 3 years where I wanted to prove to myself heirlooms could compete equally with hybrids for flavor and yield and beauty. So I have all of that data in the back of the book and in the appendix. I mean, I love everything about the book because I wrote it, but there are certain sections because I am into varieties and I am into the stories and the histories that I feel a little bit more proud about because they are kind of my unique ideas to include into the book.
Oh, no, it's a great book. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And and Lizzie is on a tear now. She loves it. So let's talk about tomato seeds. How do you save your seeds?
Well, I am a fermenter. I'm saving seeds from a lot of different varieties, and I'm also a seed sharer. So if I were to just spread the goop on a paper towel or a piece of newspaper, they would dry and they would grow fine, but then the seeds would all have little stuck pieces of paper towel or newspaper to them, and they're just not a clean way to handle them. So I just cut tomatoes in half when they're in perfect eating condition, squeeze the goop into a cup, and label it, and then put it outside with a paper towel over it, because once it starts to smell, which it will when it starts fermenting, the flies will become very interested in it. Only takes about 2 or 3 days in warm weather for a moldy layer to form, and that's good news. That means the gel around the seed is breaking down. That also means the germination inhibitor on each seed is about to get washed away. So you can't let it go more than 2 or 3 days. Fill it with water, stir it. The good seeds all sink, so you just decant off the yucky stuff a few times, put them through a sieve, spread them on an unglazed paper plate. I'll often do 5 varieties on the same plate, just, you know, carefully labeled. And then after about a week or so, just sitting in my office window, they're dry. Crumble them up, put them in a packet, label them, and you have tomato seeds that will last 12 to 14 years just at your room temperature. If you were to refrigerate them, you can get 20 to 25 years, but you have to put them in little plastic baggies. If you dry them down well and put them in plastic or glass, you could store them in the freezer and they'd last for 50 years.
So wonderful. We have to run,
sure.
Craig. I'm so sorry. I want you back to talk about your Dwarf Tomato Project book, which is hopefully coming out this year. Thank you so much for coming on. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. This is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network. I'm all energized about tomatoes now, growing tomatoes. I'm very excited. I'm going to go home and look at all the ones I have growing.
I hated that we had to cut the interview. I mean, it was short. It was it was longer than our normal interviews, but to me, it was cut short. I was like, I'm sitting here going, I'm doing my countdown to Teresa, and I'm going, okay, I got 8 seconds extra before I have to press the button. And I'm like, I don't want to cut him off.
He was really good. A big thank you to Craig LaJoie. If you would like to get his book, Epic Tomatoes, it's a great book. And we will have him on again because he's writing another one, and I know that one's going to be epic too as well. So Howie Peterson from Peterson's Nursery, our sponsors in Lakeland, thank you very much. Go in and tell them hi. He wanted to let you know that the Ridge Orchid Society is having an orchid show in Bartow today and Sunday from 10 to 4. And so it's going to be at the Polk County Extension Office in Bartow. So go by if you love orchids and want to learn more about orchids. It's a great event, and you will get to see the Petersons, and they have great orchids too as well. So thank you very much. So Aida wanted to know, in text message she sent, she said, can you have too many worms in a raised bed or in your landscape? And so the answer is no, you can't. They are great for your landscape and for the raised beds. They recycle the soil. They eat the nutrients. They eat, you know, any of the compost that you're putting in there, and they create great fertilizer. So no, too many worms is not a bad thing in a raised bed. Great question, Aida. Thank you for listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. And so I have a text message. Would putting black plastic over large box planters sterilize them? And how long should we keep the black plastic on? Well, if it's a planter and it's above ground, I don't necessarily think that it's going to be beneficial or necessary to sterilize it for the 6 to 8 weeks that you do a solarization for your pots when you just have that little amount of soil. So I would just say if you have nematodes in that soil, go ahead and get rid of the soil, put it in the compost pile so it can, you know, decompose again and be reused or recycled in the future. But start off with fresh soil, organic soil or potting soil or soilless mix in your planters. I don't think putting the plastic on it is going to be necessary because then you can't use your planter for 6 weeks. I could see doing it in the ground or if you have an area, but not planters. Great question, though. So then Alice in Volusia County, she had a question on her turf. And so we can't see pictures on our text messages here. So if you will send photographs to our Better Lawns and Gardens website, betterlawns.com, and you can send an email and it will allow you to upload your photographs to that, then I can respond. But she says she's put chinch bug killers on it and she's watering it. So here's the point that I think I can say without having to see the photographs, that if you had chinch bugs and they did a lot of damage, then that's not going to come back very quickly. And so you might just want to replace that sod in that area. But it's so important that you have consistent watering or rainfall in your yard. And so with the drought this year, a lot of yards had without irrigation had a hard time keeping up with the extreme heat and with the lack of rain. So it's just going to be stressful to your landscape. So you might have to do it over again, Alice. I'm so sorry about that, but you just want to stay on top of it and reduce the amount of turf you have. You know, make your garden beds a little bit bigger, have less turf, and it'll be less area for you to have to maintain. So comments and questions for Teresa. Thank you. This is from Muggsy in Daytona Beach. She loved the tomato discussion. Thank you. I did too, Muggsy. And so, yeah, that's really great. If you didn't hear all of Craig's interview, we'll be uploading it today to the website. And so you'll be able to hear it again. She said back in Ohio, she had a rain barrel that she used to water her plants when needed. Here in Florida, she has a healthy lake in her backyard. It has active fish, turtles, snakes, ducks, and every so often a gator. Is it a good conservation watering practice to use lakes water to irrigate my veggie and flower pots? Yes, It's great to use it because you do have nutrients in that water from the algae, from the fish, you know, fish fertilizer, and all of that. That's great to use for your pots, your planters, even your yard. It's a great way to recycle, and it's going to be very beneficial for your yard. And so you're not going to harm anything using lake water. You just want to make sure that you're not overdoing it, because usually when we have lake water, it's a well. And with a well, you can't tell how much water you're using. So, and you don't have to pay for it. So especially if it's free, we tend to overuse things. And so I would just use the same amount, just 1 inch of water, calibrate it, figure out how long it takes for your irrigation system to apply that. And that way you'll be recycling the water. You'll be doing a good thing, not using potable water on your edibles or on your landscaping and turf. And that will be a great way to use the lake water. So very good question. So thank you, Cocoa Beach, for the comments. We do appreciate it. And so if you go onto our website, betterlawns.com, I show you what you can do this month in your garden, and we still have a couple more weeks of it. So we are starting now to plant for the fall vegetable garden. Also, too, you can read my articles, and I talk about this month, about growing plants that are good for the bath, that make your bath time more luxurious. And so you can go on and see that. Also, too, you can find out a little bit more about my Ireland trip next year, 50 Shades of Green. I still think we can take one or two more people, but you want to go on these trips. We have a great time. We geek out at all the plants, and you can find out more about that on our website, betterlawns.com. We eat at fabulous restaurants. We have wonderful hotels, and it's just going to be a wonderful trip next July 6th through July 14th. I think we can take one or two, but just check. We may have already filled up, and I don't know yet.
And I love that. I'm so excited for you. I can't wait for you to get back so I can hear all the cool things.
I'm going to bring you back shamrocks.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about. I need some luck.
Shamrocks. And so that would be great. If you'd like to learn more about me, you can go to my website, www.she-consulting.com. And we will be posting all the links that we talked about today on the show. So I'm going to be posting about National Indoor Plant Week, and different types of plants that you can have indoors. I started to talk about that in the first hour. And we do have, let me see here, what can you use for a dark interior house? What kind of plants can you grow? Sansevieria and ZZ plants. You can grow that. If you have a room inside your house that has tall ceilings and bright light, you can plant or have a fiddle leaf fig tree, which is beautiful, or a variegated Ficus benjamina, a fig tree. Variegated fig tree looks amazing. For southwestern or modern or Mediterranean indoor themes, succulents do very well in bright indirect light. They don't need a lot of water. They don't get insect problems on a general basis. And they are a wonderful way to incorporate some of that Mediterranean feel into your home. And also, too, desert rose grows very well indoors. So desert rose is also a succulent, has beautiful flowers, requires bright, direct sunlight in order to grow and bloom properly. It is the best to place the plant in a south-facing window or other location where it will receive at least 6 hours of sunlight a day. All right, so if you have a bright room, patio area that you would like to have a really easy care plant, desert rose is this. Now, when you have indoor plants, you want to make sure you have good air circulation. Good air circulation to prevent disease and insect issues. You want to have a good soil mixture, water consistency. You may not need to water as much, but it still needs water. And then you want to make sure that you rotate your plant so that all the sides of the plant get enough sunlight. Thank you, Lizzie, very much today for all your production. You're just the best.
Oh, thank you. And we have the best listeners. So thank you for your calls, your texts. We appreciate you because without you, we could not do this show.
Exactly. I'd like to thank Dana Venrick for of Quality Green Specialist Nursery for the first hour. And fall trees, go by and see how beautiful his trees are. You can get them in your car, I guarantee you. And they, or he can deliver them to you, and they are beautiful. And you can have fall color here in Florida. Look at all the trees that are changing now.
I love this.
You'll know that. Yeah. You can see them by the side of the roads. Just check it out. Keep your eye on the road, though. And then also, too, big thanks to Craig LaHoulier, Tomato Man, for his wonderful information. If it's Saturday morning from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios, you're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network.
If you guys are interested in winning Trans-Siberian Orchestra tickets, go to our website, WFLAOrlando.com. And oh yeah, by the way, we have Beach Boy tickets that we're giving away too, WFLAOrlando.com.